Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
I'm particularly delighted with this weekend's topic, friendship, in general, but also friendship with God. But as a good Thomist, to get to a proper understanding of friendship with God, we first have to understand what friendship is. St. Thomas would ask us and invites us to break it down that way. To begin with what we know best and most easily in order to climb, ascend to understanding realities that are less immediate to us, less apparent, but no less real for there being less apparent. So something like friendship with God. I mean, who would ever think such a thing were even possible outside of the Christian religion? But given that is the high end to which we're called, how do we even begin to understand that? Aquinas would invite us to say, well, first of all, let's not try to jump in immediately to the deep end of the pool. Let's go to the shallow part. We all know what friendship is, and let's begin there, you know, with and just explore what it is that friendship is, and then we can begin to think about and contemplate, and hopefully by that contemplation, enter into the great mystery by grace to which we're called friendship with God. I'll begin with a question of who do you think introduces friendship into Christian reflection, Christian theological reflection? Who introduces friendship as an important topic in kind of Christian theology and Christian reflection? Who do you think? Who do you remember? Any guesses? Want to take a wild guess?
St. Paul.
St. Paul? Okay, not a bad guess. Why St. Paul?
Because I just thought that he would be more correlated to the topic because he was one of the apostles that really did well evangelizing and coming out and spreading the word of God.
Mm-hmm. Probably made some friends
along the way.
Made some enemies also, and some non-friends. Yeah. Not the name I'm looking for, though. What do you think? That makes friendship an important topic, focus of Christian reflection.
Jesus.
Jesus. Yay. That's the name I'm looking for. And why Jesus?
Well, he had his 12 apostles that he lived with and went about daily life with. And they were like friends as well as he was there.
And how do you know they were friends? And not just like master disciples or students of a teacher. I mean, are you all like best friends with your professors?
All best friends.
Oh. When does he do that?
Somewhere
in the Gospels, you're right. John 15:15, at the Last Supper. The night before he dies, he gathers them one last time. He does a lot that night. Institutes the priesthood, institutes the Eucharist, gives them the example of love and service and the washing of the feet. But John has him also in that Last Supper discourse, introducing a great mystery that we've spent 2,000 years as Christians reflecting on. No longer do I call you servants, Christ tells the apostles. I call you friends. Why? What's the next part?
For your honor, for your servants, you would keep my commands, but then...
Anybody else? I know you call you servants for friends, because a servant doesn't know what the master's doing. But I've revealed to you everything, you know, that I've heard from my Father. More or less, I'm paraphrasing. But Christ, not only in that great mystery of the Last Supper, transforming, deepening the relationship of the apostles to him, actually reveals to them then the very foundation of that new relationship, its knowledge. A knowledge that of what the Father is doing, what God is doing, and it's just not a kind of generic abstract knowledge, but a kind of knowledge that brings one into participation with the life of the Master. Why are you friends? Well, because you share in the life of the friend.
We can become friends with God because God incorporates us into his life. And by knowing and by loving, we participate in that life. Friendship then, from the very beginning, becomes an important theme for Christian reflection, Christian theology. We see it in St. Paul. Pull it out, tease it out. Various of his letters, but also in the apostolic age, the patristic age, St. Ambrose, St. Augustine. A lot to say about friendship. Later on in the medieval period, St. Elwer de Rivaux has a lot to say about spiritual friendship, Christian friendship. St. Thomas Aquinas, of course, as we'll reflect on this weekend, especially tonight. St. Thomas really started with argue stands out as an important figure in the history of Christian reflection on friendship, because Aquinas was the first really to see that friendship is the real lens through which we should understand the theological virtue of charity. Love. What is the love that's poured into our hearts at baptism? What is that virtue, that capacity to love God and neighbor with God's own love? Aquinas sees the whole mystery of our being able to love this supernatural, to exercise this supernatural love through the lens of friendship. He's the first, really, to do this in a substantive way. And really, from that moment on, Christian reflection has echoed St. Thomas in understanding charity in terms of friendship. What I'd like to do tonight to begin the retreat this weekend and our reflection on friendship with God is to look at friendship. And really the metaphysics of friendship, which Aquinas develops, borrowing from Aristotle and others, but reflecting deeply on the gospel, especially John 15:15. Christ makes us his friends. What is that friendship? How does it occur? What's its object? What's its end? What are the mechanics of that friendship? Aquinas helps us to understand all of this. This is an important topic, and a lot of ink has been spilled on it just within the last 100 years. And so that's what I'd like to review tonight and kind of introduce you into that conversation. So here we go. So in 1943, as the Second World War continued to rage, the Thomist philosopher Charles de Koninck published a brief but fiery essay entitled On the Primacy of the Common Good Against the Personalists. In this essay, de Koninck takes issue with several aspects of a new doctrine of human dignity that various personalist writers at that time were advancing. One aspect of the personalist doctrine that troubled de Koninck particularly concerned friendship, namely what some personalist writers were identifying as the source of the love that binds friends together. De Koninck challenges what he sees as the worrisome personalist innovation with classic Thomistic teaching. He writes, "Others are not the reason for the proper lovableness of the common good. Rather, under this formal relation, others are lovable insofar as they can participate in the common good." De Koninck is speaking here specifically of the common good of the family, countering the claim by some personalist writers that the goodness and dignity of individual family members founds and causes the goodness and dignity of the family as a whole. To the contrary, de Koninck argues, the good's causality runs in the opposite direction, not from person to thing, but from thing to person. Not from family members to family, but from family to family members. In other words, it is not the goodness of the individual family members that makes the family commonly good and lovable. Rather, the members of a family become lovable to each other because they enjoy, even before they converse in familial ways, in a kind of communication with each other, a communicatio, or return to this word over and over again today, a communicatio within the same higher and common good, in this case, the good of the family. Contrary then to the personalist claim that friendly relations form a family, de Koninck insists instead
that a family forms friendly relations. The common good of the family provides both the principle of and the context for the love that develops between family members and binds them together, personally. The love of Homer, Marge, Bart, Lisa, and Maggie should not make them the Simpsons. De Koninck might argue of this if he were alive today. Rather, their being the Simpsons, makes it possible for Homer, Marge, Bart, Lisa, and Maggie to love each other as relatives. Elsewhere in his essay, De Koninck makes the same point reference to the common good of beatitude. The communication with the common good establishes the communication of individual persons among themselves. The common good, qua common good, is the root of this communication, which would not be possible were the divine good not already loved in its communicability to others. Here, De Koninck's language becomes more technical, but his purpose remains clear. He explains that to understand the conviviality, the friendship of the blessed in heaven, which we just celebrated 2 days ago, one must point to its source, not in the saints themselves, but in the communication, the communicatio, of the divine good. Because the blessed all love the same good as the same good for all, then they love each other as lovers of the same good. As in the family, therefore, so too in heaven, common good founds and causes interpersonal relations of love. Contrary, then, to the personalist suggestion that friendly saints form heaven, De Koninck insists that heaven forms friendly saints. The common good of beatitude provides both the principle of and the context for the love that develops between the blessed and binds them together personally, in glory. The love of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John do not make them blessed. Rather, their being among the blessed makes it possible for Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John to love each other as saints. While De Koninck highlights in his essay the community-inducing character of the common good, he spends little time describing either the metaphysics or the mechanics of the common good's community building or friendship building. Likewise, while De Koninck assures the reader of his argument's Thomistic foundation, he does not pinpoint his sources within St. Thomas's works. And what follows, therefore, I hope to provide these elements missing from De Koninck's presentation by placing his observations in conversation with contemporary scholarship on Aquinas's doctrine of communicatio. This scholarship confirms St. Thomas's awareness that friendship between persons requires some foundation other than the good character or the goodwill of the friends themselves. This foundation lies not within the friends, but outside of them, in a social context that unites them in some shared love or activity prior to their being bonded by friendly affection. As we shall see, appreciation of Aquinas' doctrine of communicatio allows for a deeper comprehension of De Koninck's polemic with the personalists, and why he confidently applied the classical doctrine of the primacy of the common good against the personalist doctrine of the primacy of the person. At the same time, De Koninck's defense of Aquinas' doctrine of the common good allows for a deeper reading of the contemporary scholarship on communicatio. While modern scholars have helped their readers to appreciate the role that communicatio plays in Aquinas' theory of friendship, they neglect to convey Aquinas' sense that, as the principle of friendship, communicatio has a principle of its own, the common good. As I will show, De Koninck's review of Aquinas' doctrine of the common good complements contemporary scholarship on Aquinas' doctrine of communicatio by showing how, for Aquinas, the common good as the principle of communicatio serves accordingly as the principle of friendship. Before we begin to examine St. Thomas's doctrine of communicatio, a brief word about De Koninck's argument against the personalists is in order. With me so far? Okay, good. In the primacy of the common good, Deconinck reviews Aquinas' doctrine of the common good for a very specific purpose: to counterpose Aquinas' teaching to a new conception of human dignity then proposed by an ascendant group of personalist thinkers. Deconinck judges this new theory of dignity, however well-intentioned by its authors, to stray imprudently from classical orthodoxy. Deconinck observes in the principle, in the personalist theory, that based on their sharp distinction between the human creature as a material individual and the human creature as a spiritual person, the personalists conceive of not only a new principle of human dignity, but also a new principle of human society. They no longer believe, like St. Thomas, that the principle of society rests in the common good, which the personalists deem perfective only of man's lower material individuality. They locate the principle of society instead within man himself in his generosity, which the personalists assert flows naturally from man's higher spiritual personality. Accordingly, the personalists argue that human persons, qua persons, associate with each other freely and spontaneously, not because of anything that they share, but because of their natural generosity and magnanimity. And the personalist conception of friendship, therefore, generous souls simply incline to generous souls. In natural societies, however, the personalist suggests that something else, something less dignified, less personal, obtains. In the family and in the city, generous souls do not incline to generous souls, but instead needy bodies depend on needy bodies. Warning of the naivete of such a social theory, Deconinck points in primacy to the negative effects that such thinking could have on real societies. Though Deconinck does not identify the personalist writers whom he criticizes, one can find the anthropological and social ideas that he critiques in the writings of Emmanuel Mounier, the founder of French personalism. For example, Mounier employs the personalist spiritual person, material individual distinction in his 1936 work, Personalist Manifesto. Dispersion and avarice, these are the two marks of individuality, Mounier writes. The person is marked by self-mastery and choice. He is generous. In his inner orientation, the person is turned in the exact opposite direction from the individual. Mounier theorizes here that the human being, as a material individual, discovers himself as a material object in a material world, thrown in and scattered among other material beings with whom he is ordered toward interacting materially, that is, in a disordered, impersonal, and even avaricious manner. As a spiritual person, however, the same human being possesses the vocation to self-possession and self-determination, and thus he is ordered toward engaging other persons in a spirit of generosity. Mounier, the person-individual distinction has implications for how we should understand human social relations. While natural to human beings, life in the family and life in the city has an important but limited value. Family and civic life draws the material individual into materially associations with other material individuals. Over and above these material associations, spiritual associations of generosity and love become possible to human beings not by virtue of their families or their cities, which pull them downwards, by virtue of their spiritual personalities, which push them upwards. When later in his manifesto, Mounier describes his vision of personalist society, he repeats his view that man's natural societies provide him less than a fully personal life. A personalist civilization, he writes, is a civilization that orients its spirit and structures toward the fulfillment of each of its constituents as persons. This civilization recognizes the reality of natural communities and their proper finality, which is different from the simple sum of individual interest and superior to the interest of the individual considered materially. Nevertheless, these natural communities have as their final end to empower each individual to live as a person, that is, to reach a maximum of initiative, of responsibility, and of spiritual living. In this passage, Munye again identifies man's life in the family and in the city, or what he calls life in the zone of the social, as constituting part of man's material life. He asserts simultaneously that any material good is oriented to the person's spiritual good. Munye therefore leads his reader to the conclusion that the individual's social life as something material lies beneath and therefore is to be sublimated into the person's spiritual life. In other words, the good of one's community exists to serve the good of one's person. In Primacy, de Koninck notes how personalist descriptions of social life like Meunier's differ from classical conceptions of man's social flourishing. Among the differences that de Koninck notes, the most grievous is what he sees as the personalist reversal of what Aquinas understood to be the ordering of man's particular good to the common good. For Meunye, the person does not rest in his end when his family or his city flourishes. Rather, his family and his city rests in their ends when the individual person flourishes, as when he emerges from his natural communities, their good sublimated into his particular good, more a whole to himself than a part to the greater wholes of the family and the city. According to this description of human happiness, de Koninck warns, the common good no longer constitutes the final cause of human flourishing. Instead, human flourishing constitutes the final cause of the common good. In staunch opposition to this view, de Koninck cautions his readers over the consequences that personalist theory might have for real societies. Families and political communities cannot long survive, de Koninck warns, if the self replaces the common good as the goal and end of human social life. Meunier was not the only high-profile personalist thinker to elevate the person's particular good over the common good in this way. In Jacques Maritain's personalist thinking also, which paralleled but did not intertwine with Meunier's, the spiritual person-material-individual distinction features prominently. This is true especially in texts where Maritain applies his personalist thinking to political theory. In his 1940 work Scholasticism in Politics, for example, Maritain introduces the question of the relation of the person to society, which he calls the fundamental subject of all social and political philosophy, by outlining the distinction between the person and the individual. For Maritain, mastery of this distinction is prerequisite to any speculative treatment of man's political life. It is impossible to discuss political philosophy, Maritain writes, without first embarking upon an abstract philosophical consideration concerning individuality and personality, two notions which are usually confused and whose distinction I consider to be highly important. Accordingly, one finds in Scholasticism and Politics articulations of the person-individual distinction like the following. The human being is held between two poles, a material pole, which in reality does not concern authentic personality, but rather the material condition and the shadow, as it were, of personality, and a spiritual pole, which concerns personality itself. Maritain takes care not to be misunderstood on this point. He clarifies that the two poles of man's identity do not create in him two selves. There remains in man one self, but with two distinct principles of identity and action. It is the same entire being which in one sense is an individual and in another sense a person. I am wholly an individual by reason of what I receive by matter, and I am wholly a person by reason of what I receive from spirit. Of man's material individuality, Maritain writes, one might say that in each of us, individuality, being in one, that which excludes from one all that other men are, is the narrowness in being, and the grasping for oneself which, in a body animated by a spirit, derives from matter. Pretty negative view. Of man's spiritual personality, Maritain paints an opposing, more positive picture. The notion of personality does not refer to matter, as does the notion of individuality applied to corporeal things. It refers to the highest and deepest dimensions of being. Personality is rooted in spirit, insofar as the latter stands by itself in existence and superabounds in it. Meritain describes the contact of these two principles in a single human being in the following terms. Man, he writes, insofar as he is a material individuality, has but a precarious unity, which wishes only to slip back into multiplicity. For matter as such tends to decompose itself. Insofar as we are individuals, each of us is a fragment of a species, a part of this universe, a single dot in the immense network of forces and influences, cosmic, ethnic, historic, whose laws we obey. We are subject to the determinism of the physical world. But each man is also a person. And insofar as he is a person, he is not subject to the stars and atoms, for he subsists entirely within the very subsistence of his spiritual soul, and the latter is in him a principle of creative unity, of independence, and of freedom. Meritain asserts in this and similar passages that, as a material individual, the human creature is subject to the laws of physics, biology, history, society, and all of the other laws that govern the material universe. As a spiritual person, however, the human creature soars above the stars as an instance of creative freedom in an otherwise determined universe. Meritain's description of the polarity separating man's constitutive principles could not be starker. What concerns critics like de Koninck is the way in which personalists like Meritain set the realities of human personality apart from and above the exigencies of human individuality. The personalist comparison of the body and soul seems always to exalt the soul to the degradation of the body. A single soul is worth more than the whole universe of bodies and material goods, Meritain writes. There is nothing above the human soul except God. In regard to the eternal destiny of the soul and its supratemporal good, society exists for each person and is subordinated to it. Based on his understanding of the distinction of spirit and matter in the human being, Meritain describes the mature person as one who surrenders to the upward thrust of his spirit in defiance of the downward pull of his matter. If the development of the human being follows the direction of material individuality, Meritain writes, he will be carried in the direction of the hateful ego, whose law is to snatch, to absorb for oneself. In this case, personality as such will tend to adulterate, to dissolve. If, on the contrary, the development follows the direction of spiritual personality, then it will be in the direction of the generous self of saints and heroes that a man will be carried. Man will really be a person, insofar as the life of spirit and of freedom will dominate in him, that of passion and of the senses. As in Meunier's writings, the person-individual distinction in Meritain's works has the effect of sublimating the material good of the individual to the spiritual good of the person, which at the same time subordinates the common good of the individual to the particular good of the person. Social interaction, therefore, has a new purpose for Meritain, at least in comparison to Aquinas' thinking. Aquinas roots the social interaction of human beings in the common good. Like Meunier, however, Meritain roots the friendship of persons as distinct from the social association of mere individuals in the native generosity of the human spirit. As the greatest thing in creation, the person has no choice, finally, but to love all things for the self, whose innate greatness stands as his temporal final end. Accordingly, only God demands more love than the self. This is not a hindrance to friendship, however. For Meritain, the spirit's abundance of goodness spills out in generosity in a kind of self-diffusion toward the recognition and confirmation of other persons. Thus, in personalist thinking, does the self become the principle of friendship and communion. In his criticism of the personalist doctrine of human dignity, which reverses the Thomist ordering of man's particular good to his common good, de Cona could not be more forceful. Take note, he writes, of how the self-proclaimed personalists who put the person above the common good can no longer detect the link that binds persons together. Consequently, they replace this link with another, a sordid fraternity, that would immediately unite persons among themselves as if each individual were a common good for all the others. This amounts to making of each citizen a tyrant. Aman seibs magis quam civitate, and there he's quoting Aquinas' definition of the tyrant and tyranny. The tyrant is one who loves himself more than the city. Aman seibs magis quam civitate. According to de Koenig, the society idealized by personalist thinkers is sordid, for in it there exists no greater good for persons to love than the self. De Koenig argues that in such a sordid fraternity, or what we might call a confederacy of tyrants, there can be no friendship among persons. For each person loves the common good of the family, or of the city, for example, not for itself and its shareability with others, or for one's own spiritual self and the material benefit that he derives from it. Elsewhere in his essay, de Koenig describes what interpersonal relations look like in societies where everyone loves the common good as his own particular good. It is completely within the line of humanism, de Koenig writes, to see the first root, the most fundamental reason for the social character of man, not in the common good, but in the poetic nature of the individual, in the need for self-expression and self-communication, under pressure from an interior superabundance of pure self. Understand then that the person of the other is necessary because I feel the need to make myself heard, because I need someone to appreciate me. I need a person subject. In short, with respect to me, your reason to be is to participate in my personal life. Try that on your parents. Mom and Dad, aren't you so lucky that you participate in my life? You are for me. For de Koenig, the personalist conception of the primacy of the person proves disastrous for political theory because it identifies no principle for the ordering of human society other than the person himself. In other words, absent a common good, which members of a family or a city love as their proper and better good, each individual would have no choice but to desire and engage the life of the family and of the city in view of the next best good that he is bound in justice to love and preserve, the particular good of the self. The ruinous effect of the social aggrandizement of the particular good could not be clearer for de Koenig. As he describes above, to submit to the pursuit of the common good, to submit the pursuit of the common good to the pursuit of the particular good, instrumentalizes not only the good of the family and the good of the city to the flourishing of the self, it instrumentalizes also all the members of these societies to the same flourishing of the self. Others exist in personalist society, de Koenig laments, so that they might participate in my personal life. That is not community. That is tyranny for de Koenig. The self becomes the common good to which all others in one's life are ordered. From the Thomist point of view, the personalist instrumentalization of the common good to the particular good effectively removes the person from, by elevating him above, the communicatio established by the common good in which and for which, according to Aquinas, persons for whom that common good is perfective interact with each other, cooperate with each other, and eventually love each other. A brief overview of Aquinas' doctrine of communicatio will confirm not only de Koenig's criticism of personalist doctrine, but also his declarations repeated at the beginning of this essay that, quote, others are lovable insofar as they participate in the common good. And, quote, communication within the common good establishes the communication of individual persons among themselves. Thomist scholars of the 20th century paid significant attention to Aquinas' understanding of communicatio as the foundation of friendship. In a 1986 essay, Joseph Bobick, then an associate professor of philosophy at the University of Notre Dame, summarized their work. It's a great little article. Bobick highlights, for example, the observations of Father Leo Bond, OP, who demonstrated that for Aquinas, similitude between persons, similarity of both species and accidental qualities, does not suffice to found friendship. It's not enough for two persons to be friends simply that they're both human beings, that they're both rational animals, that similitude in being there is not sufficient for friendship. In addition to similitudo, Bond explained, friendship requires a certain communicatio, a certain being thrown in together in some social context to unite persons. This communicatio, joining persons, makes friendly conversatio between them possible. Bobick also points out the work of Jerome Rauch as a confirmation of Bond's interpretation of Aquinas' doctrine. More clearly than Bond, Rauch explains how, for Aquinas, communicatio, as the foundation of friendship, bears not the notion of personal exchange, but rather the notion of community, or the exercise of community, within which the personal exchanges of friendly conversatio take place. So that's important to clarify here. When we use the word, or at least when the medievals and Aquinas are using the word communicatio, it's not communication as we understand it today. It has a deeper, thicker sense. Communicatio is really the social reality within which individuals find themselves, which then becomes the foundation for their conversatio, what we understand as communication among themselves. All the communicative that could be intellectual, spiritual, emotional, sensual kinds of relations that individuals can enjoy with each other. That's made possible, that conversatio of friends is made possible because already they find themselves within a given social context, or communicatio, as Aquinas uses the term. In the same vein, Bobick features the scholarship of Father Josephus Keller, also OP, who noted that in Aquinas' text, as in Aristotle's, communicatio possesses at times an active sense and at other times an intransitive sense. The active sense of communicatio denotes the personal exchanges, social interactions, and common pursuits that constitute the activities of friendship. By contrast, the intransitive sense of communicatio denotes not an active communication between friends, but rather something passive, a sharing, a having in common, which centers upon something common that is simply there, as something capable of being mutually apprehended, in order thereupon to be actually mutually apprehended, then mutually valued, and mutually loved. An example of this is before any of you in here met each other, especially those of you at the University of South Carolina, all in your respective families and cities, it was the admissions office, by accepting you into the university, that created, before you even knew it, a communicatio among you. You had something shared, something in common with each other. From the moment of the decision of the admissions office, you were students of the University of South Carolina. That was the communicatio that you shared together. What then happened? Well, you got letters of acceptance. You rejoiced. You said yes. Then you arrived on campus. And because you already had that shared communicatio with each other, you begin to meet each other. You begin to speak to one another. You begin to enjoy life with each other because you were thrown in together and found yourselves already within this communicatio. Your conversatio with friends developed because of the pre-existing communicatio that you found yourselves in. Bobick points to Keller's active and transitive distinction as particularly helpful for understanding Aquinas' discussion of the kind of communicatio necessary to found friendship. Bobick writes, "The context of Summa Theologiae Secunda Secundae, question 23, article 1, makes it clear that the communicatio which functions as the foundation of friendship is communicatio in the intransitive sense. In other words, friendship is founded on, not on, our personal relations with each other, but rather on that which already binds us in a kind of community which we find ourselves in, which becomes both the context and the foundation for our conversation with each other. In other words, the inactive communication or community of persons deriving from their sharing of some good in common, like belonging to the University of South Carolina. It is the common diffusion of the good as the final cause, as a final cause that unites them. This is the prerequisite to the active conversation among persons that is observed by all as the vital sign of friendship. A careful reading of Question 23, Article 1, confirms Bobick's interpretation of it. In this article, after Aquinas explains that the love of concupiscence, or the self-referential regard for the other, cannot produce friendship, he continues, "But neither does well-wishing suffice to account for friendship. For a certain mutual love is required, since the friend is a friend to his friend." Now, such a mutual benevolence is founded on some communication. Communicatio. For Aquinas, neither the self-referential love of concupiscence nor the one-sided love of benevolence suffices to establish friendship between persons. What is required is some active conversatio of mutual benevolence in which each wishes the other his good. Aquinas is quick to mention, however, that this active conversatio is not itself friendship's foundation. It is rather friendship's flourishing. The foundation on which the active conversatio of friendship rests is some other communication or intransitive communicatio, which establishes the friends within the community of some good before they wish this good for each other. I mean, when you think about this, I mean, really, and it goes against the grain of everything, kind of as moderns, we conceive about ourselves as individuals, as autonomous. For Aquinas, there is no such thing as the autonomous individual. Every individual, simply by being, already finds himself within some technical term, intransitive communicatio, that he does not create, he does not choose, but in which he finds himself, which serves as the foundation and the context in which then he can know others and love others. Based on this reading of Bond, Rausch, Keller, and of others, Bobick concludes that Aquinas employs the term communicatio throughout his corpus to identify three distinct realities pertaining to friendship. In each case where the term appears, context helps to determine which of the three realities Aquinas is discussing then and there. In the first instance, Aquinas employs the term communicatio to denote, according to Bobick, the social relational context which is the foundation out of which friendship arises, or at least can arise. Bobick indicates that this is the communicatio that Aristotle speaks of in the Nicomachean Ethics, when he says, "Every form of friendship involves association." The associations that Aristotle identifies are of two basic species: domestic, based on common blood or common hearth, and civic, based on a common political good. For Aristotle, the two species of association possible to man serve as the foundation of various possible species of human friendship into which one may enter, namely the friendships between husband and wife, between parents and their children, between siblings, between extended relations, between fellow tribesmen, between fellow citizens, etc. Bobick identifies this first sense of communicatio, the foundation of friendship, as a passive rather than an active cause of friendship. Bobick calls it, quote, an enabling cause, or, quote, a condition within which the active cause can bring out its effect. Bobick does not mention it, but communicatio's passive causality here reveals this first kind of communicatio as a final cause of friendship. Aquinas' second manner of employing communicatio denotes, according to Bobick, the activities of friendship. This is the communicatio that Aristotle discusses elsewhere in the Nicomachean Ethics, namely where he mentions that, quote, friendship is a partnership, implying the living together of friends, and of all the activities that flow naturally from it, namely drinking together. Aristotle mentions that first. Gambling together, second. Hunting together, playing sports together, and studying philosophy together. I don't know why that comes last. Just to name a few of the examples that Aristotle gives. This second kind of communicatio is the active cause of friendship that Bobick distinguishes from friendship's enabling cause. Although actively an initiating and perpetuating cause of friendship, Bobick says, the second communicatio remains, in essence, compared to the first, the proper effect of friendship. Here, communicatio's active causality reveals this second kind of communicatio as an efficient cause of friendship. Finally, Aquinas' third manner of employing communicatio, which is signaled by his use of the active verb communicare, denotes the, quote, offering of a gift, which provides a foundation where there was none, out of which friendship can arise. Bobick explains what this offering of a gift entails. He writes, whenever two persons, a superior and an inferior, have nothing in common, but the superior offers a shareable gift to the inferior, not only the two begin thereby to have something in common, communicatio in the first sense, which makes friendship between them possible, but it becomes fitting that the inferior respond to the initiative of the superior by doing whatever he can to make actual the friendship to which he has been invited. For Aquinas, this communicatio of superior to inferior is precisely the kind of communicatio that God establishes with man in ordering him the gift of beatitude. This offering by God establishes between God and man a kind of sharing where there was none, a sharing of final happiness, which establishes between them the kind of social context out of which friendship between God and man may develop. Aquinas writes, since God communicates his happiness to us, there arises some communication, communicatio, between man and God upon which some friendship ought to be founded. The love founded upon this communication, the love founded upon this communicatio, is charity. For Bobick, this third manner of employing communicatio is Aquinas' contribution to the Aristotelian discussion of friendship that Aquinas inherits. Whereas Aristotle rightly concluded that no communicatio naturally unites God and man, given their ontological distance from each other, Aquinas radically describes the communicatio supernaturally established by God in the Old and New Covenants. In summary of Aquinas' teaching, Bobick explains, though God and man are infinitely apart, infinitely unequal, with respect to virtue and ability to delight and ability to be useful, they are nonetheless, or at least can be, members of the same social group. As members of the same social group, Aquinas teaches, God and man can become friends. The communicatio that God establishes with man enables man to conduct a conversatio with God. No longer do I call you servants, I call you friends. Bobick's survey of Aquinas' doctrine of communicatio both enlightens and is enlightened by Taconic's survey of Aquinas' doctrine of the common good. Bobick's survey enlightens our understanding of Taconic's assertion with which we open this essay. Others are not the reason for the proper lovableness of the common good. Rather, under this formal relation, others are lovable insofar as they can participate in the common good. Though Taconic does not use the term, communicatio is the presumed reality upon which he builds his point. Taconic argues that the loving conversatio of family members is not the cause, but rather the effect of their lovable communicatio in the common good of the family. Accordingly, the friendship of family members roots itself not in some generous interior principle, as the personalists contend, but in the members' possession of one and the same common good, good of the family, of which each member constitutes a part. Bovik helps us to identify the participation in the common good of which de Koninck speaks as the communicatio that Aquinas highlights in his first manner of using the term. Conversely, Bovik's treatment of communicatio is enlightened by de Koninck's treatment of the common good, particularly by the second of de Koninck's quotations referenced in the introduction above. The communication with the common good establishes the communication of individual persons among themselves. Though Bobbick does not specifically mention the common good in his descriptions of communicatio, de Koninck helps us to see how Bobbick constantly refers to it. In de Koninck's description of friendly relations among persons, he makes it clear that the communication of individual persons upon which their friendships are founded itself has a foundation. It rests upon the communication of individual persons, the communicatio of individual persons, with the common good. The common good, the good of the person better than his particular good, insofar as it can be shared, and its very shareability, establishes its beneficiaries in a social context wherein they may converse as friends about what they share. Thanks to their communication with the common good, individual persons communicate in a shared social context, out of which can arise the conversation of friends. All right, thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.